Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Christine Lamberson, and I'll be your host for today for this channel. Today, we're talking to Max Felker-Cantor, who is an assistant professor at Ball State University, and we are speaking to him today about his new book, Policing Los Angeles, Race, Resistance, and the Rise of the LAPD, that has come out in 2018 from the University of North Carolina Press. Hi, Max.
Hi, Christine. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. I'm excited to talk to you about your book.
Me too.
To get started, can you just tell us a little bit about how you got interested in being a historian and in this topic in particular?
Yeah. So it's a really interesting question that could go back, you know, all the way to undergrad and college of why I got so interested in history, taking classes, in history as an undergraduate, and really being confronted with questions of historical interpretation and how historical interpretation could change over time based on present questions, and that history was really all contingent on the questions we asked based on the present, really got me interested in becoming a historian and going to graduate school. And part of that process then was also the kind of thrill of archival discovery, which I'm sure will come into my discussion of the book as well, is that I just got so fascinated by thinking about how history was made by going into archives and finding sources and then putting together a narrative out of what I found. It was just kind of a light bulb went on when I started to do that, both as an undergrad and then, of course, in graduate school in much more depth. And so that is kind of how I started thinking about why I became a historian and what really got me interested in it. And to the second part of that question about why I got interested in policing, and I see myself as a historian of both policing, but also of the larger kind of turn in the carceral state, is I was in graduate school from beginning in 2008. And I was in Los Angeles, which partially explains why I was interested in writing about Los Angeles, kind of fascinated with the city around me and the racial politics of that city, but also the timing of graduate school, of when I was starting my dissertation and thinking about my dissertation, was a moment in scholarship when the attention to the history of mass incarceration was becoming much more a topic of study and of much more interest to historians, especially in the post-World War II period. And so I was thinking about those questions from a scholarly point of view that I just wanted to ask about Los Angeles. And alongside that, I was really had been engaged in archival work in Los Angeles through graduate school, and had encountered a number of collections and sources, in particular at the Southern California Library, which is a community library that holds records of activists and community organizations from Los Angeles. And I encountered a whole range of source material on activism and anti-police abuse activism in Los Angeles from the 1960s all the way to the present. And so it was through that archival discovery as well, as I was rooting around, that I started to bring in questions about, well, how should we see the police in LA history, and anti-police activism in particular was what really got me going on that topic to begin with, was this piece on activism. And in particular, I'm sure we'll talk about the Coalition Against Police Abuse later, or CAPA, but that was the collection that got me kind of really into this project. And then I'd say a third part, of course, that got me kind of interested in this topic in particular was also the particular historical moment of 2008, 2010, when there was a kind of growing societal concern around mass incarceration right on the cusp of the Black Lives Matter movement. And so I was inspired to ask new questions of the past based on my present experience as well. So those three things really all came together kind of at one moment, both a historiographic change, my own experience in a city with archives, as well as new questions about the past based on my present situation and the present situation of policing in the United States in the 21st century.
Okay. So I do want to talk more about those activists. And I also later on want to talk a little bit more about, now that you've done all this research, how it kind of fits into our present moment. But before we do that and talk more about your book in a bit more detail, I was wondering if you might, for listeners who maybe haven't been following recent history and recent activism quite as much, if you might just give us the quick version of the arc of policing and the policing changes that you're talking about here. So your book goes from the Watts riots to the LA riots in the 90s. So that sort of 40-year period, or perhaps more broadly, essentially the last 50, 60 years, if you might kind of just give us that broad overview of sort of what's happening in policing in urban spaces in the United States in general.
Yeah, I mean, in general, and Los Angeles, as I suggest, can be kind of seen as a model for this. But in general, policing through the 1950s and into the 1960s, by and large, is undergoing a process of professionalization. So police officers in many cities are starting to be paid more. They're starting to be seen as professional organizations. That's part of an effort to get rid of corruption in police forces that had been, you know, that police forces had been corrupt and on the take in the 1920s, 30s, and urban machine politics in the kind of early 20th century. So in the 1950s, there's these movements to professionalize and reform and to say that the police are not corrupt and that they're, you know, the kind of professional crime fighters that we see in kind of the old movies. So this is if anyone knows, it's Dragnet, which is a LA TV series from the 1950s, which I don't write about, but that's the kind of iconic professional policeman. And so there's this moment of professionalization, but in by and large, it's also shaped by racial segregation in cities as well. So those police forces in this moment are often seen as really enforcers of racial segregation as well. And so African-American communities, by and large, don't get the same type of policing in the 1950s and 1960s as white communities. And so there's responses to policing that is seen as discriminatory. And as many activists would say, they were occupied, that their communities were occupied by the police. And so that pushes forward really demands for the police to change. And so you get all sorts of calls in the 60s and into the 70s for police forces to have more diversity in the people they hire. So hire more diverse police forces to solve some of the discrimination that was seen in policing, more community relations programs, more human relations trainings. And so there's moments in the 60s and 70s to reform the police, to try to make them more reflective, so to speak, of communities and more responsive to community desires. That transforms again in the 1980s and into the 1990s with the rise of what is called broken windows policing and new attention to low-level crimes in communities. And this is the kind of stop-and-frisk policing that people may have heard about that starts, you know, in, by and large, this moment is in New York City under Chief William Bratton and others, where they say, we're going to crack down on low-level offenses to stop crime, bigger or higher order crimes. And so there's a transition there where you get a new form of policing in terms of really involved in the daily life of communities. And of course, that's all plays out on a racially discriminatory or racially segregated landscape. Alongside of that, there's a whole trajectory in this period of what we might call police militarization. And so the police from the 60s forward are getting more militarized in the sense of they're getting funding to buy things like anti-riot gear, SWAT teams, and those sorts of things that we also associate with the war on drugs in the 1980s. And so the police are undergoing these multiple transformations between the 60s and the 90s on a variety of levels, whether it's their political organization and shifts from professional to these professional police forces, and it, as well as militarization and how they're policing, and then in the kind of strategies they use when they start to say, we're going to now move from kind of these reactive police forces to proactive police forces with broken windows, saying we're going to go out and find crimes and try to prevent them before they happen. And so policing is going through kind of major transformations in all those ways.
And so you touched on this just a little bit in your answer already, but could you talk a bit more about why Los Angeles is a particularly good place to be thinking about some of the questions that you're thinking about in your book? And of course, you're talking about some very LA specific events, including those two bookends for your book, but you're also certainly making an argument that Los Angeles tells us something about the United States as a whole. So could you talk just a little bit about that relationship?
Yeah. And the way I kind of talk about this in the book, and the reason why Los Angeles becomes kind of a model for the rest of the nation, is that the LAPD or the Los Angeles Police Department was oftentimes on the front lines or on the front of the innovations of many of these changes in policing. So they become a model for other departments around the country. So the LAPD is one of the first to really say, we're going to professionalize in the 1950s and in the 1960s under Chief William Parker. And so they start to institute a lot of those professionalization policies as well. That makes them kind of on the forefront of changes in policing. They are also on the forefront of developing new strategies and tactics. So the first SWAT team, for example, comes out of Los Angeles after the Watts uprising. And so in 1967 and 1968. And so they're on the forefront of using technology. And so there's a whole thing of using computers in the 1970s in LA to help police to be more efficient. And so Los Angeles becomes, and the LAPD in particular, becomes a kind of really model department that is also being exported to other departments across the country, which makes it a really interesting place to look, both for some of the origins, but also just as it's constantly working to reinvent itself over time. The other thing that makes it really interesting in terms of a model for the nation, especially in northern cities, is that Los Angeles has a black mayor, and a number of northern cities have black mayors. And so Los Angeles becomes a kind of interesting model there to think about black mayoral power in an era when there's a lot of black politics. And of course, the other thing which I talk about in the book is that Los Angeles is this really multiracial city, really for the whole time that I write about. So it's a multiracial city in the 1960s. It has a big black population. The Mexican American and Mexican population in the 60s is a large one. It undergoes dramatic demographic shifts with immigration in the 1970s and 80s, both from Asia, but also from Central and South America. And so Los Angeles, and some people make the argument California as well, you know, is on the forefront of demographic changes that we're seeing in the country more broadly later on as well. So Los Angeles provides a model to think about how police interact with a city that is becoming more multiracial and dealing with questions of immigration in a way that other cities then have to deal with as well, but on slightly different timelines, perhaps. And so in all those ways, Los Angeles can become a really interesting and place to look at policing, but also can help us think about policing more broadly across the country during this period that I'm talking about in the late 20th century.
I don't want to walk through every single piece of your book. I hope that listeners will read it and learn more after our conversation. But I think it makes sense to still start with the place that you start to talk a little bit about or to set up the types of reforms, changes, and activism that your book is tracing throughout this period. So what happens with the Watts Riot? And not, I don't just mean, you know, what was the Watts Riot, but more precisely, how do people in Los Angeles interpret and respond to this event in different ways, right? And of course, I just called it a riot, as it's often known, and you've called it an uprising. And that difference in some ways highlights some of the differing interpretation by itself. But could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. And so the start of the book is by and large, it's with Watts in 1965, in August, when the city goes up in what I call an anti-police protest from the African-American community in response to a Black motorist being pulled over, arrested, and rumors of police brutality spread throughout the Black community. And this comes along on a long history of police discriminatory policing and tension with the Black community, which I won't go into here, but is part of the book about the backdrop that leads to this moment of tension. But coming out of this moment of a violent anti-police protest for 6 days, there's multiple ways that the city responds and different constituencies in the city respond. So from the African-American community, I presented and argue that it's really is political protest that is demonstrating the real discontent with how their community has been policed. And of course, this is coming within the context of larger social and economic inequalities. I don't want to downplay that. But with my focus is saying that actually, we really need to understand the real discontent and dislike of the police and the way that the Black community has been policed in this era of the 1960s. To understand Watts. And so coming out of that is we really need some fundamental changes to how the police act in Black communities. And so that's where I use this kind of moment of uprising as a political response, without getting too much into the word choices and the politics behind that, because I've also recently read some new pieces on maybe riots is a better discussion actually to describe that those events, because they show the real rage at policing. And so that I'm not going to get too much into that, but the Black community is expressing a real animosity towards the police and calling for reform. But at the same time, coming out of Watts, the police, and they're still under the command of William Parker, he dies in 1966, so there's a shift of leadership. But under William Parker, and in this moment in 65, the police receive overwhelming support from the white community coming out of this unrest. And so Chief Parker gets like thousands of letters that say, "We appreciate the way you handled this uprising or this riot," as it would have been called, "and we think that you are basically an upstanding police department and you keep our communities safe." And so the police are getting criticized from the Black community, But at the same time, the white community, and this is a largely segregated city at the time, are praising the police. And so you get a different interpretation there of what this event meant. And what I argue is the context of that is what allows the police coming out of Watts to say, we need more authority and we need more resources to make sure that no more riots occur in the city. And the other thing that comes out of this is that by and large, politicians are supporting the police as well, coming out of the Watts unrest. And in particular, the McCone Commission, which is set up by the governor to investigate the Watts riot, as they called it, that commission comes out and says, by and large, we think William Parker and the LAPD are doing a good job across the city, and that they are are an efficient police force that respects everyone, which of course is not what the Black community had been saying. And so the McCone Commission's ideas of reform are very limited. They propose reforms such as, well, the department should hire more Black police officers because the number of Black police officers on the force in 1965 is not reflective of the proportion of Black people in the city. We need more community relations programming. The department should invest in community relations sorts of activities. And then there's some minor things, like they say, well, they should hire a new inspector to deal with complaints that come into the department. But none of those reforms really address the roots of the real discontent with the police in the African-American community about the police aren't actually held accountable when they abuse or in times kill African-American residents. That there's no discipline, that the chief of police still has the kind of ultimate authority over discipline in the department, that the chief of police still has basically life tenure because they had civil service protection. And there's no civilian input over discipline. So there's demands for things like civilian review boards, which don't go anywhere because the police and the McCone Commission and city politicians don't see it as necessary. And then there are some politicians to kind of add to this, African-American politicians and council members in particular, Tom Bradley being one of them, who are saying, we do need to make some changes to the police department, but they're not taking the kind of bigger steps to say, let's like restructure the whole thing. And so you get these multiple strands of proposals and demands that come out of that Watts moment, which I suggest is kind of activists saying we need a lot more movement, and the police on the other hand saying actually what we need coming out of Watts is more authority and more independence.
So how does this play out? And I mean, there aren't the types of massive change that many of the activists were hoping to get. But you are making an argument that their activism still very much matters and that they are in many ways reimagining the potential relationship between the police and communities. And so could you talk just a little bit about their activism and how what kinds of changes they are making, even if it's not the sort of thing they're hoping for?
Yeah, and so that's a really great question. And so what you start to see after Watts is that you have African-American activists starting to form new organizations. So in particular, the one that comes right after, or in 1966, after a real tragic killing of an African-American motorist who is taking his wife to the hospital because she was pregnant and going to have their child in 1966, is African-American activists form what they called a community alert patrol. And so what they start to do is they form a group that says, if no one's going to watch over the police, we will. And so they organize into a group that then would go out at night in cars, where they would then just follow the police and they would observe arrests and try to show that they are, that the police were being watched, to try to ensure some form of fairness and accountability. And so there's that kind of moment, and that community alert patrol becomes a similar model that would be taken on by the Black Panthers, both in Los Angeles, but also in Oakland, where you'd get, you know, this idea of community control of the police, in a sense of, we're going to come watch you and really try to say, let's bring accountability. And the community alert patrol is one of the first examples of that. You also have other groups, as I mentioned, like the Black Panthers forming. So within the Black Power era, you have organizations starting to develop that are using things like mass protest tactics, where they're confronting the police, they're going into the city council building and testifying at hearings after episodes of police abuse, where they're trying to pressure the city council to make changes in the nature of policing in the city. There are efforts to try to organize campaigns to create a civilian review board in the city. Now, it's not successful, but what it leads to is a growing commitment within the community to try to hold the police accountable. And so it also leads to the ACLU forming police complaint malpractice centers. So they create these offices where community members can come and give reports and complaints of police abuse. So it provided an avenue when people didn't think that if they went to the police department that their complaints would be heard. And so some of this activism actually leads to alternative ways that the community, African-American community and Mexican-American community is doing this as well, where they find ways to say, we'll find avenues to voice our complaints and try to hold the police accountable, whether that's following the police, whether that's, you know, collecting our own complaints in these malpractice complaint centers. The Mexican American community is holding, there's an organization that forms called the Barrio Defense Committee, and it's led by a lot of Mexican American women, where they're organizing the community in East Los Angeles primarily in response to the discriminatory treatment of Mexican American youth, as well as the kind of a number of killings and abuses in county jail. So they're organizing around that and bringing communities together to try to bring justice to the police in those instances as well. And so it's this real grassroots effort to put pressure on the police in these moments. And the argument I make in the book, which you allude to, is that these movements are really important for essentially putting the police on notice, that there's really pressure on them. And of course, this continues into the 70s, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And that what the argument of the book is that this all lays the groundwork for, this activism lays the groundwork for larger changes to come in the future, is that we don't get bigger reforms, because some bigger reforms come later in time. But these are small steps that activists use that then create a momentum against the police within African American and Mexican American communities in this moment, that may not have changed everything in 1966, but by 1970, 1975, they're starting to see greater changes in police policies.
Okay.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, zucchini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Can we talk a little bit about the 70s? And in particular, I want to talk about once Bradley becomes mayor, in particular, the politics of having liberal law and order, basically, of having this new mayor who is pursuing more reform than some past officials have, but again, nonetheless, not necessarily fundamentally changing the relationship between the police and the people.
Right. And so Tom Bradley is an African-American man who was mayor of Los Angeles. He's elected in 1973. He's there up through 1992. So he's elected to five terms. He's there for 20 years. And his backstory is important because he was a 21-year veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department. So he had been a police officer before he enters politics. And so he always has, you know, one of the arguments I make is that we have to understand his perspective as one of being a police officer, but also someone coming out of the Black community that is really saying we can't have the police acting in a discriminatory fashion. And so when he's elected, he's promoting, well, we can have law and order, we can have a safe city. And part of that's electoral pressure to get elected because the city's only about 19% Black when he's elected. So he has to appeal to white voters. So there's part of that that he's responding to. But I also argue that his vision of what we might call liberal law and order and policing is one that really the problem is not the kind of fundamental power the police have, but it's just that they need to be regulated and overseen in a way so they apply the law fairly. And so that we can have safe communities and everyone can have efficient and good policing as long as the police do that in a fair and even-handed manner. And so what that allows, I argue, is that then it enables him to release the police in their kind of authority to maintain order in the city while they gain power at the same time that he says, but we're going to create kind of a more fair system. And so this leads to a whole range of things where he eventually they change, like they change the officer involved shooting policies and force the LAPD to have new sorts of policies and when you can use force and pressure on the LAPD to diversify more. So they do start to hire more African-American officers in the 70s and into the 80s. And so Bradley is this interesting figure because he, I think, is a proponent of we're going to have a safe city, but his policies that say actually enable the police to actually expand their resources and authority in the city because he's just saying, well, we'll just apply the law fairly to everyone without really a change to the structure of policing that was already operating on these kind of unequal bases. And so he becomes, that's the kind of moment where we get both liberals and conservatives promoting law and order under the Bradley administration. And he's critical, and he doesn't do too much to actually call out the police in his first term. And he does so, and this is where activism is important, is that you have groups of activists, in particular the Coalition Against Police Abuse, which forms in 1976, and it's a multiracial group of activists that are coming together and saying, if we all join along common lines of our resistance to discriminatory or racist policing, we can have a greater influence. And so they raise a lot of pressure on Bradley and other politicians after moments of police killings of Black and Latino residents and some white residents as well. And so like in 1977, there's a white man who's killed. His name is Ron Burkholder. And these activists organize and put pressure on the police department in Bradley to take a stand, to change LAPD policy. But the big one is in 1979, when a woman by the name of Eula Mae Love is gunned down by two police officers in her front yard. And she's a 39-year-old African-American woman. And there's an outpouring of protest from both activists, but just community members in the African-American neighborhoods, especially ministers. And it's really the first time that forces Bradley, in his time as mayor, because before that he was saying we need to rein in the police and we need to kind of make sure the police aren't being discriminatory. But it's the first time he really takes a strong stand and says, we are going to investigate this killing of Eula Love. I demand, you know, that the police really be accountable for this. And it leads to a whole, he asked the Board of Police Commissioners to investigate this killing, which leads to a four-part report that goes into vast detail on all the missteps the officers took and how then proposals to change training of use of force and a whole range of other proposals around, again, human relations training. But it's the activism there around continued police abuse that forces, I argue, Bradley to start taking an even greater stand against the police in the late 70s, even because he, within the context that he had actually, I argue, empowered the police in some ways at the same time. And so the activism becomes this back and forth with the pro-police converging interests in the city.
So before we talk a little bit about the 80s, another area where your book talks about some of this kind of back and forth or some of the reforms, but that also continue to increase power, police power in new realms, is in the juvenile system. I was wondering if you might kind of pick out a little bit of that thread to highlight for listeners as well, especially because I think in that area we can see some issues that continue to be at the forefront of these kinds of questions today.
Yeah, and the youth policing that I'll talk about is also the precursor to probably what we'll talk about in the 1980s when the war on drugs and with the war on gangs in particular, because Bradley's elected in 1973, as I mentioned, and it's actually in that year there's this rising concern about what they call, you know, juvenile delinquency or youth violence in the city. They're not talking about it quite in the same way as we think of like in the 80s with, you know, this kind of gang warfare. But they're concerned with what they see, meaning politicians concerned with youth violence in the city, and particularly in schools. They're calling, like, schools are being described as like forts, and that there's, you know, these kind of youth, you know, thugs, sort of in schools. And so Bradley comes into office, and one of his campaign pledges is to address the rising youth violence. And so what I argue here is that by saying, like, we're going to address youth violence, we're going to bring safety into schools, what starts to happen is the school authorities start to say, we'll allow the police to come onto campus. We will, the Los Angeles Unified School District also said, we're going to start hiring more of our own police officers ourselves. And Bradley is organizing, he's saying, we need to have a more robust juvenile justice system as well to deal with youth crime. And so there's a lot of grants that are being made to address the juvenile justice system. And so what starts to happen is you get the growth of policing in schools in the 1970s in response to this fear of youth crime. And so the police expand their authority to address youth violence, what they're calling youth violence in schools. Previously, those things would have been seen as just disciplinary problems that would have been handled by teachers or administrators. But in this moment, teachers and administrators are giving up that authority and the police are taking it over in schools. And so, for example, what starts to happen is you have the LAPD saying, we're going to put undercover officers in the schools to bust drug dealers. And so they bust all these young youth, what they call drug dealers. And so there's a growth of arrests around drugs and youth violence in schools there. And this is happening in a kind of racially discriminatory manner, differently in white schools versus black schools. This is also where the LAPD's community resources against street hoodlums or crash units form in the early 1970s, 73, 74, where they're forming these, what become the anti-gang units, is that they say, well, we have to deal with youth violence on the streets, so we're going to develop new units to address that problem. And so they create the crash units, you know, by and large, in conjunction with these political concerns that youth violence is a problem. And so then they start to develop new techniques to track young, predominantly black and brown men oftentimes. And so, and they create these file card systems in the early, in the mid-1970s, where they record the names and the descriptions and appearances of youth they come into contact who they suspect of being gang members. And they have real broad latitudes of how they describe gang members. For example, like their guidelines say things like, black gang members like to wear black t-shirts. And so in these kind of files, and they, so they then use this overly broad categorization to really criminalize youth in new ways. And part of the point there is that the police are doing this, but they're also doing this in the context of politicians, Tom Bradley and other city council members who are saying, and school administrators who are saying, we've got to deal with growing youth crime. And so then the police take on this new authority, and whether that's in schools themselves or in the on the streets around schools with these crash units, is that they're then using the juvenile justice system to expand their discretion to police in the city.
So as they get these new types of power and new types of discretion, we still have constant activism pushing back or reforming or trying to mold police power and police relationships. Yet the police are also, I mean, one thing your book does, I think, really well is talk about the police as political actors in some ways, as you say up front. And I want to talk a little bit about sources a little bit later, but, you know, you don't necessarily have the sources to of internal police records in a lot of ways, but the police become this kind of political force to a certain extent. So could you talk a little bit about how the police are going about responding to activists and including the ways in which they are instituting a system of surveillance of activists as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And one I get a fair amount about, the police are responding to the pressures from activists in ways that I hope my book shows. And I think, and I'm pretty, and the argument I make is that the police are really these partisan entities that are really strategic in how they are wanting, constantly wanting to maintain authority and to expand it. And so they respond to anti-police activism by labeling it largely as criminal or labeling it as a subversive threat, and that it needs to be in many cases surveilled and watched over. And so the LAPD has its own intelligence division called the Public Disorder Intelligence Division, or the PDID. And what they start to do is say, well, these groups are, and they're surveilling pretty much every kind of political oriented group in the city, both on the conservative right as well as on the kind of the left. And so, and in particular, anti-police abuse groups they're surveilling in particular, they're really concerned with. And so the police start to use the framing And this is what I, when I argue in the book, is about the police actually are really active participants in constructing what the threat is to the city, because they're the ones saying, like, well, now we have a youth crime crisis, or now we have a growing subversive threat. And they're framing then anti-police abuse activists, in particular the Coalition Against Police Abuse, as a threat to the city. And so they then engage in infiltration as well as surveillance of those groups in the 1970s, where from the very beginning of CAPA's organization, they had officers, intelligence officers, at some of the first meetings that the Coalition Against Police Abuse had. And they were recording what was happening at those meetings. And within a matter of months, the intelligence reports are saying back to LAPD headquarters, these informants are saying, CAPA has grown immensely, and it's one of the most dangerous organizations to the city. And so they then use that to try to frame anti-police activism as a threat, in what I argue as is a means to then say, this requires us to now have greater authority in the city. The thing that ends up happening with the Public Disorder Intelligence Division is that activists find out about all this infiltration of anti-police abuse groups, largely, and they're all peaceful, nonviolent protest organizations. They find out about the political infiltration of the city council when there were hearings about police abuse. So especially around the Eula Love case, when there were hearings about the officers and the LAPD practices that led to that killing, they had the LAPD intelligence officers recording parts of those hearings. And as activists hear about this, and this is one of the kind of biggest moments of triumphs in the late 70s and early 80s, is they bring a lawsuit against the police for what was really just politically motivated spying. And they're successful at uncovering this broad web of spying and infiltration by the LAPD that then actually leads to the dismantling of that intelligence division in the early 1980s. Due to a lawsuit. And so it's this interesting moment again where the police are actively trying to expand their ability to maintain information and surveillance on those groups they perceive as threatening. And at the same time, activists are become aware and push back at what was really unconstitutional policing at that moment. And so it's a moment of triumph for activists and the activist community, especially the ACLU, the Coalition Against Police Abuse, and a number of others, where they're actually able to dismantle this intelligence division. Now, it gets reformed later in a new iteration. So the police come back and say, "Well, we still need intelligence gathering, but we'll reform it into a new office within the department." And so there's always this kind of dialectic going back and forth between the two. But it is a moment of success that's also indicative of the way the police are trying to always respond to groups that are saying, we want to take and restrict police power in the city.
So as we move forward, could you talk a little bit about kind of what is the reformed version of policing in the 1980s? And you talk about a few different types of things in the 1980s. You talk some about the global migration and kind of changing economic situation in the city and how that feeds into policing of immigrants. But then you also, of course, talk about the drug war as well. And so I was wondering if you might talk a bit about the types of policing and the changes that then set up the conditions that will lead to another outburst of violence and conflict in 1992 in the LA riots that become sort of the other bookend of your book.
Yeah, so what is happening in LA in the late 70s, early 80s is the city goes through a kind of economic restructuring. The city loses tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs. So there's rising unemployment, in particular in the African-American community in the early 1980s. The city is also, and as part of that economic restructuring, there's a rise of a service sector. So low wage work in service industries that's coming to replace what were at one point higher wage manufacturing jobs. And so the city is, but you're getting growing unemployment, but also the jobs that are coming in are largely low wage and not as well paid. And so there's a restructured economy that is also happening within the context of growing demographic changes. As you get the disruptions in South and Central America and Latin America is largely coming out of a Cold War context, as you have interventions by the United States, in part in El Salvador and Nicaragua, is that you have a lot of refugees who are fleeing to the United States, and they come to places like Los Angeles. And these immigrant and refugee populations become new targets of police. And so there had been a long history of the police and the immigrant community in Los Angeles back to the early 20th century. But what's happening in the 80s is the police are saying, we have a problem, is that we want these new immigrants and refugees, and they're not necessarily using refugees, but that's a different kind of a side part of the story. But they're saying we need immigrants to report crime and to trust the police, because we have this growing population. And if they're not willing to trust the police, it's going to lead to a rise of crime. And so they're saying, and so they say, and this is under Chief Daryl Gates. And they say, well, so what we're going to do essentially is pass what they called Special Order 40 and say that the police will not investigate immigration violations, will only investigate kind of criminal violations. And we won't ask about immigration status in certain instances. And so they're trying to say, we won't enforce immigration law because we want immigrant communities to report to the police. But at the same time, what's interesting is that they start to see the behaviors and activities of especially El Salvadoran and Mexican immigrants who are doing like street and day labor because they don't have many other employment opportunities, where they're selling food and other things on the streets, as a kind of new threat, as a crime. And so they say, on the one hand, we're not going to investigate and not going to enforce immigration violations, but we will start to then criminalize street vending and other behaviors that are, you know, quote unquote, happen to be associated with immigrants. And so on the one hand, the police are trying to say, we're going to restrain our discretion here to police these immigrant communities. But at the same time, they have a kind of a double move where then they say, but we're going to enforce these new city ordinances against street vending. And so then they start to target immigrant communities in new ways in the 1980s. And this would lead, which we'll get to with 92, is a real kind of targeting of immigrants during the 92 uprising, when a lot of undocumented immigrants get arrested and some of them deported. And so there's this moment in the 80s where actually the foundations for targeting of behaviors and activity, especially around employment of immigrants, starts to develop. At the same time that this is happening, you have the growth of concerns around a rise in drug use, especially with the introduction of crack cocaine in the city in the early 1980s, as well as what is perceived as a connection between that rising drug trade and gang violence, especially in the African American and Latino and Latinx communities. And I use Latinx at this moment because the demographics of the population have shifted from one that was primarily Mexican American in the 60s to now what is really a a broader Latinx demographic with immigration from El Salvador, Nicaragua, and others. And so there's this connection that starts to grow between that the police say, well, the drug trade is driven by gangs and gangs are violent. And so what we need is a new form of policing to address this gang drug trade activity that is ruining the city. And they're supported by politicians in this, such as Tom Bradley and others we've talked about, to say we're going to crack down on this new form of gang violence that's connected to the drug trade. And so they start to engage in widespread raids in South Central, the African American community, to crack down on drug dealing, and to sort of what they say is to raid and arrest gang members as well. And so they're starting to also use new types of technology in terms of weapons. And so they acquire things like this tank-like vehicle that they put a 14-foot battering ram on the front of, where they use it to knock down the doors of supposed drug houses and what they call rock houses. And so they're starting to perceive these threats and to use new types of militarized force. And so they expand into this militarization in a new way, because they justify and they say, well, the drug trade is a violent one because it's controlled by gangs. And that's not entirely true, because there's evidence that from the police's own records that not all the drug trade was controlled by gangs. But the framing of it, both by the police and the media, was that all of the drug trade in the city is controlled by gangs and therefore violent. So we need this new militarized authority. Along with that, they're engaging in new types of monitoring of supposed gang members. So they have these new databases where they start to input into computerized databases the individuals they arrest or they come across who they think are gang members. So this is the origins of what becomes CalGang later on. It's a statewide gang database for California, but some of these start in LA in the 1980s. And so they're starting to surveil Black and brown youth using these databases. They are also then engaging in mass arrest tactics, where in 1988 and 1989, it's the kind of notorious Operation Hammer, which is on weekends, the LAPD would flood, largely in South Central in the Black neighborhood, they would flood it with officers and and round up any youth they thought might be a gang member. And that could really be any African American youth between the ages of 12 and 28. They, you know, could all fit the gang member profile. And they would then hold them at the LA Coliseum, just south of USC, for 24 hours. They oftentimes found no evidence of a crime and made no charges against anyone. But they would enter them into these gang databases and then release them after 24 hours. And so it was a kind of early kind of, or it was a form of mass criminalization of youth of color in the city. And the connection that's interesting there to the immigration story is they're also using those tactics to say, well, we're not going to police for immigration status, but many immigrants coming in are part of this gang violence. And so they're able to then frame immigration around gang violence as a means to kind of arrest and round up oftentimes undocumented immigrants at the same time that they're policing in Black neighborhoods around the drug trade. And so you get this growth of police militarization and really the policing of kind of the everyday life of African American and Mexican American residents, and Latinx residents in the city during the 1980s, that really creates kind of growing tension in the city, because these communities are saying, yes, we want to be safe and we need to deal with crime and violence in our communities, but it doesn't mean that we need new military tactics and weapons tried out on us. It doesn't mean that we want discriminatory and racist policing. And so they're calling for a change to that sort of policing, saying that is, we're being treated unequally. And we're also not getting the protection we need because our communities are just being treated as criminal.
So this type of policing and this situation sets up what happens in 1992. Could you just briefly talk about what kind of effects that has on policing and policing tactics?
Yeah. And so the argument I make in the book is that we can't understand what happens in 1992 without this kind of three-decade prior kind of tension between communities of color and the police in the city, and that the war on drugs, war on gangs, is really formative to the context of 1992, when, as many listeners will know, it comes the year after LAPD officers beat Rodney King, and then the officers are acquitted in 92, and the city erupts again in this kind of episode of violent protest. And the police respond with kind of overwhelming force once again. They cooperate with the INS. They cooperate with kind of federal law enforcement during this moment. So there's a kind of a real growth of communication between law enforcement agencies in this moment. But coming out of it, as you're asking, is that it's really a wake-up call for the city once again. And it's a moment, 92, that leads to at least, well, the Rodney King beating in 91 and the unrest in 92, the rebellion, as some people call it, leads really to this moment when Tom Bradley's still in office. he doesn't run again after this, so he leaves office. And it leads to a moment when residents, more broadly than just the communities of color, start to say, like, we need to really fundamentally rein in the police. Because you get there's a series of commissions that investigate the Rodney King beating and the 92 uprising, and they say, and these commissions find, they say, there's really a culture within the LAPD that leads to an us versus them mentality. The LAPD has basically developed this relationship to the communities it's policed, where they see themselves in opposition to those communities, and they don't see them as working, you know, for the communities. And so, and this is coming out of the Christopher Commission and the Webster Commission, which were the two commissions that I'm talking about. And so these studies call for change. What starts to happen is there's a referendum that's put on the ballot for 1992 in June, which is called Charter Amendment F, which passes overwhelmingly. And that charter amendment changes the city charter. And so what they say is the police, and the fundamental thing it does is says that the police chief can no longer have life tenure. The police chief can be appointed for 2 5-year terms, but after the first 5-year term, they have to be reappointed by the Board of Police Commissioners. And they then say, like, there's also needs to be community-oriented policing projects. And so we really need to kind of change the police from what some people described as a warrior mentality. And so 92, and I argue that those changes are ones that activists had been essentially sowing the ground for decades, and that they created the conditions within which those types of reforms could take place. And so 92 becomes a moment when there is this kind of structural change to the city charter and what powers the police have, especially the police chief. And they start to enter into new forms of community-oriented policing programs. And those, by and large, initially, I argue, were meant to be a change in policing, but they didn't always end up that way. And so the real case study there that I use is Operation Weed and Seed, And that's a federal program that was started by George H.W. Bush nationwide. They had Operation Weed and Seed. And it comes in, the LAPD and LA politicians want to use that to say, well, we're going to have community policing. And part of that is going to be Operation Weed and Seed, which what they would say is, what we're going to do is weed the area of criminals, take them out, but then seed it by providing resources for the community and providing, having community relations meetings where officers would work with the community on how it should be policed. And so I argue that that really ends up actually linking police and criminal justice by saying, like, we're going to come in and weed the area of the criminals, which were oftentimes who they're seeing as largely it's Black and brown youth, and saying, linking that kind of hard power of the police to saying, well, but at the same time, we're really going to invest in social service kind of policing and be more invested in the community. And so I argue kind of there that on the one hand, you get these really important reforms to the city charter on the one hand, but on the other hand, the ways that community policing gets implemented in the city really links policing and criminal justice to the kind of social welfare side of policing when it comes to community policing. And so the police power never actually gets divorced from that. It's still centrally involved, even though they're saying we're doing something slightly different.
So throughout your book at this moment as well, there's this push-pull, as we've been talking about, between activists and the police. And there are moments where a number of features of policing do get reformed, but police power is not necessarily decreasing or fundamental relationships are not necessarily changing in the types of ways or in the size of ways that many activists are hoping. And I'm wondering if you might talk a little bit about what this means for thinking about our present moment. As you mentioned when you started, that you started your research in the context of Black Lives Matter, which is certainly a movement that's still around. And we are also in a moment when there's lots of maybe fits and starts, but nonetheless, a few signs of the possibility and interest in possible criminal justice reform in a variety of different ways. And I'm wondering kind of what you think this history might tell us about the possibilities for that reform.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, one thing that I hope the book does, and that I think the argument I try to make, is that in some ways, this history of activism in the book is one of is really shows us the kind of long legacies and the historical legacies of our current activism around policing. Is that anti-police activism in our present didn't come from nowhere, especially, you know, if we look at particular cities. So a lot of the activists who are in LA recognize that history. So there's a number of groups I cite in the book at the end, like the Youth Justice Coalition and the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, which is a coalition of groups that are really recognizing this longer history of activism and police power. The thing that I think the lessons that this history shows is that, I mean, that activism is crucially important to demanding and trying to hold the police accountable. Because if not for activists, the police would essentially be able to act with an even greater free hand in the city. That the activists were the ones throughout this period that were saying, we are going to try to hold the police accountable and expose the episodes of police abuse and oftentimes killings that the police don't always want exposed. And that's, I think, a lesson that we see today with Black Lives Matter and other, especially around social media and cell phones and all that we see activism continuing along that path of, like, now we have an ability to kind of expose these incidents. But I think the other lessons that these activists, the history that I recount in this book show, is that reform to the police is one that is not going to happen all at once. That it's a part of a kind of longer process that sometimes happens in fits and starts, that you have moments of bigger triumph, but that it's not one that that's going to change overnight, and that the activists I show in this book struggle for decades to push back at the police. And I think that's something that we see today as well. And then the kind of bigger point, which perhaps is the most difficult one, is what the activism here shows, and the activists that I write about are aware of this. And I think you see that with some of the criticism today from activists who say, like, well, certain reforms, just like putting body cameras on police, aren't going to fundamentally change the fact that we empower the police to do certain things. And so I think the history shows that really, if we want fundamental changes to the police, that's a much bigger change that we have to make in society in the United States, to think about what do we actually think and empower the police to do in our society, and what authority do we give them? Because that's a much bigger kind of fundamental question that the history I show is really what activists are pushing at, but that is a really hard one to successfully accomplish. And that's why I think Bradley, and we saw this with, like, you know, Barack Obama as well, you know, there's criticism of, you know, with Ferguson and Baltimore and others, is, well, yes, we can call for more body cameras and more policing, but we really need to have a discussion of what do we actually think the police should be doing in society, and what power do we give them? What authority do we give them to enforce what we call crime or order? And so that's a much bigger question that I think my book can shed light on, is that we really do have to have those discussions if we think we want to move forward on this question of police reform.
Mm-hmm. Those are incredibly important questions, and ones that I hope our listeners will be thinking about. I don't want to abruptly change topics here, but I did want to ask you a little bit about doing research on the police, which is a sort of, at least among historians who do this kind of thing, an infamously difficult task. You, for your book, use a lot of records, as you mentioned at the beginning, from activists. And you mention in the book that you tried to get more records about the LAPD, but that there was resistance to that. And I was wondering if you might just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and so that's the kind of doing police history and archival, you know, and trying to do archival work around policing is, as many historians would say who study this, it is really difficult, as you said. And I was really lucky in a lot of ways, in the sense that the activists that I followed through the archive collected information on the police as they were engaging in protest and other sorts of forms, and so or in their other activities. And so they actually collected. So while I don't have LAPD official records from the department, oftentimes these activist groups collected official LAPD documents and archived them as part of their archive as well, which was so fascinating, is because I could almost piece together bits and pieces of an official LAPD archive, but through activists, alongside that I was doing the work of finding the records of the activists and their organizations as well, is that they were really concerned with tracking the records of the police, because they knew at the time in the 70s and 80s that it was really important to collect police records at that time. And so that archival journey was really informative to thinking about how could I get at the police and really write a history of the police and anti-police abuse activism without having records directly from the department. And so activist groups were crucial. The other avenue that it took me, and I think my archival journey, I would argue, also is suggestive of my argument that the police had become, in some ways, more involved in a variety of areas of life in the city, because I found records of police, you know, when I went to the school board records. I found records of the police when I went to city council office records. I found records of the police when I went to the mayor's papers. And so as I started to do a much broader archival journey, what I found was the webs of police records and archives became part of the archival record of a whole range of activists, politicians, the school board and other institutions in the city that allowed me to piece together that story in a really interesting way. And so that archival journey was one that took a lot of work, but it required also thinking about how to get at the police without actually being able to go to the police department and say, can you give me all your records? Because as you mentioned, I did that and I filed a public records request, which while I was finishing was unsuccessful, that they'd never released any of that information. There have been some subsequent lawsuits that have released some of that historical those historical records. And so the kind of source piece was really, I thought might be an obstacle, but it was one that I was able to follow these strands through the city in a way, like through the archives, I was able to follow strands of policing through the city. And so that journey kind of parallels, I think, part of the argument about police power that I'm making in the book.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and thank you so much for spending time talking to me about it. Before we go, can I ask what you plan to work on next?
So I'm working, yeah. And thank you again for this was a great conversation and for your discussion of the book. I am currently working on a project that builds a little bit out of this book on the DARE program and the war on drugs. And so what I'm interested in starting to investigate now is thinking about anti-drug education and anti-drug kind of prevention in the 1980s and 1990s as kind of what I'm more or less referring to as the kind of soft side of the war on drugs, is that we have histories growing, more histories of like the policing side and the punitive punishment side. But there's a whole other side of the drug war, which has to do with police in schools, with anti-drug education, in particular DARE. And so I'm starting a project on that and doing some writing on that. I'm also interested in starting a project on how police departments communicate with each other throughout the kind of post-World War II era, in particular the International Association of the Chiefs of Police, and thinking about your kind of original question about why Los Angeles is actually thinking about how police really shared information across the country. And so one of the other kind of sub-research project that I'm kind of starting right now is to think about the International Association of the Chiefs of Police and how these departments were actually sharing ideas across different regions in the post-World War II period.
Well, those both sound great. I look forward to reading them.
Thank you.